Our last two sessions, we quickly surveyed what is in our book, Principles of Interpretation by Clinton Lockhart. Those axioms and those rules provide the basis for the interpretation of normal human communications, written or verbal, past or present, sacred or not. But of course, we're going to be applying them particularly in the area of the study of the Bible. And hopefully, as we now move on to look at some other things and start making practical application of what we have talked about so far, you'll start seeing those principles showing up, and you'll start realizing you're doing it yourself, and you always have done it, without having known there was a, quote, rule that went with that. Let me call your attention for a few moments to your assignment, because it really is the focus of what we're going to be doing the next two class periods together, the assignment 3. I hope you still have that in your possession there. And if you have not filled that out, this is not my normal recommendation, but if you have not filled that out, I hope during the course of our class period this morning, as we talk about these things, you will fill it out. I realize that for some this might be a new way of thinking, or I'm asking some things you're not used to trying to do, perhaps. But we really want to not just give you some rules and guidelines, but actually, in a sense, put our hand on top of your hand, and just like my first grade teacher did, and show me how to make the letter A and the letter H and the letter R by actually putting her hand on top of mine and helping me trace over those little dots that were in the lined paper for our Western character set. And by the way, did you know there's a scripture where that actual imagery is contained in the scriptures? This is where doing some word study comes in valuable. But in 1 Peter chapter 2, as Peter's having to write to these Christians and enjoin upon them the importance, on the one hand, of living lives consistent with their calling, and at the same time to equip them and prepare them and strengthen them for the persecution that had already begun. That's sort of the background to all that's happening in 1 Peter. And so he says in 1 Peter 2 and verse 13, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority. Even in time of persecution, they were to obey the governmental authorities. And he tells them why. That would put to lie some of the false things that were being said about the Christians. And then in verse 18, slaves, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect. Those who were actually bond servants, who were in slavery but had become Christians, they needed to show as Christians that they were respectful and obedient to their masters. They didn't seek to run away or anything like that. And then as he's talking about that to the slaves, but of course it really extends out to everyone, he says in 1 Peter 2:20, but how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in His steps. Now first, you know, we just take it for what we hear there in our English translations. We should follow Jesus' example. But that word example in the Greek language there is, I'm working off of memory, but I believe that word in the Greek is the word hupogrammos. Only place it appears in the New Testament. And in the Greek language, the word grammos, from which we get our word grammar, grammos meant writing or to write. Hupo meant over. So hupogrammos meant to write over the top of. And the scholars tell us that that word was used in two situations closely connected together in the ancient Greek world. The one is that when schoolboys and girls, but unfortunately I have to tell you that it was mostly boys in that day that got education, not women. But when schoolboys were first being taught their Greek letters, they were often issued a wooden tablet that had a wax surface on it. And underneath that thin layer of wax, written onto the wooden tablet itself, were the letters of the Greek alphabet. And so when the wax was laid over the top of that, it was thin enough and clear enough that they could see the letters underneath. And so they, in a sense, learned their letters the way many of us learn to make ours, by tracing over the top of what they could see underneath. And so that was hupogrammos, to write over the top of. It's what a schoolboy did when he was learning the basics.
What passage is that in?
That's in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 21. Want no German today? Gesundheit? And so that was the first way they used that word hupogrammos. The second way was closely allied to it. The schoolmaster, the man who was in charge of the school, or sometimes it was also the man who, if you were in a wealthy family, they sent a servant to school with you. And so while you were at school, you had a servant there. But he wasn't there to wait on you. He was there to make sure you got there, got home, did your job while you were there. And that's the sense in which in Galatians chapter 3, where it talks about the law was a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. That's the way that word is being used there. And of course that word doesn't appear in this passage here, but sometimes it was necessary for the schoolmaster, either the teacher himself or the older slave who was in charge of this pupil, to actually put his hand over the top of the student's hand and help him make those letters until he got used to what it felt like to make those kind of marks and to make those letters. We still do that today. I've got a granddaughter that's a little over 3.5 years old, and she's brought me a card she made for me just yesterday. And she said, "Look, Papa, I made you a card." And she says, "See, on the front it says, 'To you' on it." Well, it actually doesn't say any such thing, does it? It's just some scribbles. And on the inside are pictures of her and three of her cousins and her mama and her papa. Well, all six of us in the picture, each one of us is a round circle with two dots on it. But she used to couldn't draw the round circle. But with her mother helping her, and even when she's been over at my house, when I help her, we'd take our hand and with her hand and help her learn how to draw a circle. Learn how to draw a circle. Hupogrammos. This is what happens when you get beyond just what we're reading in our English translation and do a little word study and a little background research. And it tells us here that Christ suffered for us, leaving you an example. He left an indelible mark on that wooden tablet that we are now to trace over with our lives. And perhaps it's not too much to say from the passage that He even steps into our life as we go through these things and is there guiding us and helping us through them as well. Okay. As we start now looking at our paper for today, the assignment for today, we're going to start doing some of what we've said. One of the axioms, several of the axioms actually, but one in particular focused on the fact that an author is influenced by his background, his culture, and all of those sort of things. And one of the things that really is prominent in the Gospels is the temple in Jerusalem. In fact, I was thinking last night, and I was trying to remember when Jesus was in Jerusalem, do we ever find Him anywhere other than at the temple? And the first answer to that is yes, we do. But the second part of that answer is we hardly ever find Him anywhere but at the temple when He's there. We do find Him at the Pool of Siloam, the Pool of Bethesda. We find Him in the upper room the night before He dies. And I think we'd struggle, at least in my memory, that's only three other places I can remember Him being when He was in Jerusalem that it actually mentions specifically where He is. And yet it tells us numerous times that He was up at the temple.
Just in the Mount of Olives.
Yes, that's outside of Jerusalem. Right across the where I grew up, we'd say right across the creek from it, because there was, between the eastern border of the city of Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives, there was a ravine through which the Kidron Brook ran, and so they call that ravine the Kidron Valley. And so they had a couple of bridges were actually built over it, one that ran straight to the Mount of Olives and another one down lower that bridged over this ravine for travelers who were coming in from Bethany and from the highway that came from that direction. Yes? Yes, you're right. Yes, he was called in. In fact, now that you mention that, the whole series of places he was at during his trial and so forth. He was apparently at Annas's house, the old high priest, and then they carry him over to wherever the Sanhedrin was meeting, and apparently even goes to wherever, to Herod's palace for a few minutes or an hour, and then to Pilate's place, which almost surely was probably the Antonia Fortress just north of the temple itself, before he's finally carried out. Thanks for reminding me of that. But the overwhelming, at least, majority of the places where it talks about where Jesus is when he's in Jerusalem is going to be at the temple, somewhere in the temple. And the first thing I always want to do when I'm going to study something like this is I want to see what the Bible says first, not last. And so that's a lot of the focus of your handout today was that. In fact, let me talk to you a little bit about just in general how I go about and how I recommend you think about working on projects. You might just call this a study methodology or a project methodology. Now, the first thing I do is I try to define the goal or the purpose I have. And sometimes that's defined for me, with me preaching on the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. In a sense, my goal or my purpose is already defined by choosing to teach on that passage. But it goes more than just say, well, I want to know more about Galatians 5, 22 and 23. My goal or my purpose is to take each one of those characteristics of the fruit of the Spirit, to discover what it means, to see how it is used in the Scriptures, and then see how it is applied to Christians. And then after I've done that, then conclude each one of my lessons, each one of my studies with the congregation, with how that practically transfers over from the New Testament and New Testament Christians to us today. Like this past Sunday, we did the one faithfulness. And so I had to talk about what did faithfulness mean, what was the Greek word, how is it used in the Scriptures. It's actually used in three different ways in the Scriptures. The context usually makes it very easy for us to tell which one of those three meanings are meant. And then after we talked about that, then we looked at some passages in the New Testament where the word is used, where it talks about God is faithful, God's word is faithful. Paul talked about some of those who worked with him, like Epaphras, who was a faithful minister of Jesus Christ. Jesus told a parable, actually told several parables in which men were made responsible for things by their masters or by their king. And then when the king or the master comes back, he calls them to account for what they've done. And those who had done what they were supposed to do, they were called good and faithful servants. That's all the same word right there in Galatians 5:22 about faithfulness. And then we found many general admonitions to New Testament believers to be faithful, including the one in Revelation by Jesus himself, be faithful even to the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life. And then we made that application. The word faithful there in that context meant trustworthy, reliable, to endure with conviction. So he's calling on them to be trustworthy, reliable, dependable, to both be people who will not give up their faith, and yet at the same time, in very practical ways, be people who can be counted on, can be relied upon, who are people both of their word and of their commitments. That's a part of the fruit of the Spirit in a person's life. Well, yet that's defining the purpose of the goal of your study, and then starting to carry it out. So then after I've defined what's my purpose or my goal, then, secondly, I start to collect my data, my information. And that, for me, always means starting first with the Scriptures. Don't let other things define the Scriptures for me. Let the Scriptures define other things. And so I start collecting my first data. And that means starting with the Scriptures. And then from there, depending on what the nature of the study is, go to my interlinear Bible and or my expository dictionary to look up word meanings. Go to my Bible background books or Bible history books to start trying to ascertain what's going on in the context, historically, culturally, and so forth. And then after I've done this collecting process, it's almost like writing a term paper. Those of you, at least in our American educational system, remember how they used to try to teach you, that you start out by getting all the note cards, you know, 3x5 or 4x6 cards, and you write out what your research is finding on all these cards. But then at some point you have to stop and start arranging and cataloging what you've got. And see what do you have here. And you're doing that, of course, all with a view of, is it meeting your goal or your purpose? And then after you've done your catalog and arranging, then I say, okay, what's still missing here? What have I not covered that would be essential to this? That's sort of at the point in which I'm suddenly saying, okay, am I answering all the questions about this passage, about this topic? Who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much. And then I go back to collecting more information again, if I haven't answered all those questions to my own satisfaction. And then finally you pull the project together and lay it out in what, at least to you and hopefully other people, is a logical sequence that it can be presented if you're going to be teaching it, or just in a logical sequence so you can remember and have it on file for when you'll use it in the future. So project methodology, define your purpose, collect your data, catalog and arrange it, see what's still missing and go get that, and then organize it into your finished product. And then the last step for me is to say, okay, now how does that apply today? In all of this, what am I hearing loud and clear are the principles, the concepts, or the statements even plainly of Scripture that says this is what Christians are supposed to do, or what they're supposed to be, or this is how it applies. Well, with that in mind, we look at this whole thing of the temple in the New Testament, and although we're going to start out by looking at just what the Bible itself says, we can't limit ourselves to that. And I think that'll become pretty obvious rather quickly. But here's how I've stated my goal for this little project we're doing. To develop a sense of the physical aspects of the temple in Jesus' time. I don't want you, you don't have to write this down, just hear me. To develop a sense of the physical aspects of the temple in Jesus' time and the role it had in His mission and ministry. That's what I want to try to accomplish in this. So when I say a sense of the physical aspects of the temple, now let me ask you a few questions. Why don't we just go over there and look at it today if we want to know what it looked like? It's not there. Well, what happened to it? It got totally destroyed about AD 70. Is there anything over there today? Okay, I heard the Dome of the Rock. We'll come back to that. Yes, there is a Muslim mosque on part of the site. There is the Dome of the Rock, which is not the mosque. That's another building. Both of those are Muslim. Both of those were built after 700 A.D. when the temple was destroyed in 70 A.D. and Jesus was going in and out of it in the first 30 years or so of the present era, from minus 3 B.C. or so up until about 30 A.D. He made his first visit to the temple when he was about 8 weeks old. He was in his mother's arms. All that's left today of the temple that was there in Jesus' time is part of the platform, the big flat surface upon which all of this was built. When you see the pictures or the video on television of the Wailing Wall, what is that? And there you go. Back when the ocean was much higher and the water was much closer to Jerusalem.
Yes.
Yeah. Truthfully, of course, we're just being tongue-in-cheek about the whales, but the Wailing Wall in New Testament times was part of the Western Wall, the structure that if you looked up, there would be the temple up high. It dominated the whole landscape of the city. The Western Wall in places was 60, 70 feet high. And part of what's left of that Western Wall, of that temple platform, not the temple itself, just the platform, big flat surface upon which it was all built, is that Wailing Wall today. And in fact, over the centuries, as wars and destructions and rebuildings have taken place, the actual level of the street that Jesus would have walked on if he walked up the western side of the temple on the street down below is some 30 to 45 feet below the surface of what they're walking on today. That's how much, how many times the city's been destroyed and it's been rebuilt and filled dirt and crushed. Broken rocks and so forth have been shoveled in and then smoothed off and new streets built on top of it. Just been built up and up and up. And of course, because Jerusalem's still a living, viable city today, they're not going to dig down there to the old surface. There's too much modern stuff at stake if they did that. But down beneath is all this history. And that's not even counting the fact that because of the great tension among the three great world religions that all claim that as a holy place, none of them are going to let the other ones tear any of it up to see what's underneath. But Kevin?
Quick question. I thought the Dome of the Rock was a mosque. It's not the mosque.
No.
What is it?
The Dome of the Rock is the building that's been built over the spot where in the Muslim faith Muhammad was carried up to heaven and then back down after he was... Yeah, it's a shrine. And they say, and I don't know who the they is, but I believe it would be the Muslims and probably even the Jewish scholars would say that rock is where in New Testament times the Holy of Holies was. Of course, it was destroyed 700, 800, 900,000 years before this any kind of shrine by the Muslims was put up there. But this would be the place in the thinking of most Christian scholars, most Jewish scholars, and most Muslim scholars, that in New Testament times, that's actually where the Holy of Holies of the temple was located, was there where that outcropping of rock is. Because it's kind of an odd situation. The whole surface up there is flat, except in that one place. And here's this little outcropping of rock. I say little, I guess it's probably half as wide as this room across and about that deep. But this bare virgin rock sticking up there, whereas everywhere else it's just perfectly flat and smooth.
You know, I'm so grateful that God decided to make His temple in our hearts instead of in a spot. Because look at the stupidity that goes on over a spot. People fight and kill and slaughter each other, do everything God would like frown on to get a hold of a spot. But in our hearts, people can't take that. It's pretty bad.
Yes, that's an interesting observation, and so true that we're not having to fight over what they're having to fight over, because God dwells within us, not in a spot. Okay, so we can't go over there and see it today. We can see a little bit of what was once there, but most of what was there when Jesus' time is either buried beneath the present surfaces of the areas around the temple or have been totally destroyed. Well, why can't we just go back to the Old Testament? We have great detail in the Old Testament when Solomon went to build the temple on how he built it and what he made it out of. Why can't we just go back there and read all that information and fill in the gaps of our understanding of what the temple was like in Jesus' time?
Didn't Nebuchadnezzar smash up that one?
Yeah, the one we read about in the Old Testament built by Solomon was destroyed too. It was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar's troops in 587, 586 B.C. when Judah was captured by the Babylonian armies, and the temple and the city were both totally destroyed. And so it's not there either. In fact, scholars struggle to find any remnants at all of Solomon's temple. Because whatever remnants there are underneath whatever's left of Herod's temple. And now suddenly I'm calling it Herod's temple because that's how scholars refer to this temple that existed in Jesus' time. It's called Herod's temple because he was largely responsible for its construction and the way it looked. Herod the Great, Herod the Great Architect, Herod the Great King, he wanted people to think. Herod the Great Murderer. You know, he was a great lot of things. And he was a great architect. He had this brilliant mind about buildings. And he somehow believed that when he died that he was going to leave behind these buildings, this architecture that would be a reminder forever of how great he was. Well, hardly anything still exists of what he built. But what he did build was magnificent. And of course, he built it mostly on the backs of the Jewish people. That is, they provided the labor, they paid the taxes to pay for all of that. But that includes the temple. In fact, as far as the temple is concerned, we start out with a tabernacle, don't we? At Sinai, a portable worship center. And the center of it was something called the Ark of the Covenant, kept inside of a tent that had two divisions to it, a holy place and then a most holy place, and it was inside of that part where the ark was kept. And yet that could all be taken down, folded up, carried on shoulders of men, and moved to the next place and then set up again. And they used that from Sinai down until the time of David the king, a period of at least 500 years. Then David, under God's guidance, is going to build a permanent place. Now that the people of God have a permanent place to live, it's time for God's ark to have a permanent place. And so he lays all the plans, and Solomon, his son, builds it. Cody?
Just since you mentioned under God's guidance, I mean, I don't know that it's necessarily under God's guidance, it's so much under his approval.
Okay.
It didn't seem like it was initiated by God. Hey, let's build this place for me. The reason I mention that is because, you know, I was thinking of the original intent. For instance, you know, when man and woman was created, they were meant to be one from then on. You know, you see that reflected in marriage. The same thing with this temple. It's interesting to me, too, that this original temple that God said, design it, you know, make it this way, was a way that God could go with you.
Right.
You know what I mean? That you would never have to be away from God, which is another interesting idea. But then, you know, man says, well, God, we can improve on that, and we can actually make you a spot where you can stay put. Well, we go about, you know, it would be a really nice place where you can stay put. But it's just, you know, strange to me because man initiated that. David said, well, I want to build you a temple. You know, we're living in this nice place. We've got nothing for you. He had the right heart about it, but I see, again, you know, God's original design was that he would go with us.
I will rest in the place I choose. So maybe we need to call us and God chose the place.
Yeah, it's a whole different study. I wish we had the time to pursue that. Some more about, did David decide to build a temple for God, or did God decide that he wanted David's son, Solomon, to build a temple for him? And there's two sides to that view. On the one hand, it seems like at times that it's all David's doing, but then you have other statements that seem to indicate God clearly wanted this. For example, in 1 Chronicles 28, David, when he's turning over the plans for the temple to Solomon, he says, he gave him the plans of all that the Spirit had put in his mind for the courts of the temple of the Lord and all the surrounding rooms. So suddenly at least the chronicler says that the plans that David passed on to Solomon were all plans that the Holy Spirit had put in David's mind, had actually inspired him to come up with. So it's sort of a two-sided thing and a fascinating study, but a separate one from what we're doing here. But we have that, we start out with a tabernacle, then we have the temple built in all of its splendor and glory under Solomon. And it continues to exist, gets refurbished a couple of times, once by Hezekiah and once by Josiah, because it had fallen into such poor state, lack of use and lack of care, because people had turned away to idols so much. But then here comes in Nebuchadnezzar and his armies, and Jeremiah, we read over and over, Jeremiah keeps telling the king, he says, if you will submit to God's will in this whole matter and submit to the king of Babylon, then the temple will be saved, the city will be saved, and you and your family will be saved. Things go along and get worse and worse, and the king doesn't do what he says, and Jeremiah comes back and says, listen, you know, you didn't listen to me the first time, but now if you'll listen to me now, the nation can't be saved anymore, but the city and the temple and your family can be saved. Doesn't listen to him. He comes back. It's a fascinating study in Jeremiah. But it finally gets down to the point where Jeremiah has to come back, literally, while the soldiers are breaking down the walls outside, and says, because you did not listen to God's word, the temple will be destroyed, the city will be destroyed, the people will be destroyed, the nation will be destroyed, your family will be destroyed, and you'll be carried away into slavery. The king could have stopped it anywhere along the way if he had just been a man of God. But he wasn't. But the temple's destroyed. The people are carried away. The Babylonian Empire is eventually overthrown by the Medo-Persians in about 539 or 540 B.C. Cyrus or Darius becomes the new world ruler. And he starts declaring that all these foreign peoples who had been moved away from their native lands by the Babylonians could go home. He didn't do that just for the Jews, but they were included in that. And so the first group start going home, and eventually he even starts taking out of the treasuries of the old Babylonian Empire that he's now in charge of, starts releasing stuff that went to the original temple and let them take that home too. And then under Ezra and Zerubbabel, Ezra was the priest and prophet, and Zerubbabel was the governor of the Jewish people back in Jerusalem. They sort of half put together an existence in what was once the great city of Jerusalem. And then under Zerubbabel, they start rebuilding a temple. There were people there among them who were old enough, and they were quite elderly by that time, in their 80s and 90s. But as they see it being built, they cry. Why? It's nothing like what the first one was in terms of its glory and magnificence. But that one was built, and it continued to exist down until just before Jesus was born. Over 500 years. And that's when Herod becomes king, and he decides that, you know, this is kind of a pathetic symbol of Jewish religion, and he claimed to be a convert to Judaism. Let's build something much more magnificent. Let's go back and see what Solomon did and double it, basically. So he tried to make it twice as big, twice as ornate, twice as beautiful. And it, by and large, he succeeded. And that's the one we have in the New Testament. Then that gets destroyed before they even get out of the first century by the Romans. And no temple has been built since there. And so we can't go over there and see it. We can't depend on what we read in the Old Testament to give us an accurate picture of what it looked like. So when we start looking in our New Testaments then to find out what this temple looked like, I recommended to you on your sheet there that you use an exhaustive concordance to look up all the places in the New Testament, especially Matthew through Acts, where the word temple appears, and see if you can start developing a picture in your mind of what was there and what they did there. And after class last week, someone pointed out to me oversight on my part. And that is, when I'd given you a list of books that you'll be using during this time, I didn't put exhaustive concordance on there. I apologize for that. Whether you own one or not, that I intended to have that on that list when I told you about Bible dictionaries and expository dictionaries and interlinears. I intended to have an exhaustive concordance on there, but I left it off. And here I am asking you to use something I didn't tell you you were going to need. Hopefully you managed somehow to overcome that anyway.
I have a question.
Yes.
This is on topic, just because we're talking about the temple. Why is it that the Jews and the Pentecostals believe that they're going to build a temple back there?
Because of their, the question is by Cody, is why are there some groups of people, both Jewish and in the Christian community, who think the temple needs to be rebuilt? Well, I think we can see the Jewish thinking, because they're Jewish. Their religion has always focused around this, you know, a temple, a tabernacle, and then a temple, and they still think they need to have that. That's a big part of what they're about. And so for the Jewish, that's it. For the Christian groups, as we'll call them, is because of their view of prophecy and what is often called premillennialism and so forth. You know, when they read in the Old Testament, then when it says like in Malachi, then suddenly the Lord will come to His temple. I understand that to mean what Jesus did when He walked into the temple. They understand that to mean that at the end of all time, when the Lord comes back, in what we call the second coming, He has to come down to a temple. Well, if there's not one there, He can't come. And so they want to build one to make it possible for the Lord to come. That's what they're doing. That's their thinking. That's their interpretation, or, in my opinion, misinterpretation, misunderstanding of what the prophecy was all about. But and it's not just that one passage in Malachi. There's several others also that make references to the Lord and the temple, and because of their view that none of those things happened when Jesus was here on earth the first time, that then they all have to happen when He comes the second time. And if any of them that involve the temple, then that means the temple needs to be there for Him to do those things when He comes the second time. Okay, hopefully that's sort of a very brief answer to that question, but that's why there is a certain amount of interest in various Christian groups in seeing a temple built. Well, of course, that's going to be almost tantamount to a religious World War III if they should ever try to do that, because obviously I don't think they're going to get the Muslims to agree to take down the Dome of the Rock and their mosque that's there and turn that all back over to either the Jews or the Christians to build whatever they want to build on it. I'm not saying what God will allow to happen. I can see some of the difficulties involved, whether their view of Scripture is right or not. Any effort to fulfill their view of Scripture is going to have major, major consequences. And like Tim LaHaye and the late great Planet Earth that he wrote back in the 70s, I guess it was, and books he's written since then, a lot of them revolve around this very idea of a coming major world conflict between Christians and Muslims. And the effort to rebuild the temple there. All right, let's do what we've said here. This is show and tell time. Let's go to the Scriptures. Let's go to the New Testament, and let's start hearing what they say about the temple that's mentioned throughout the Gospels and in the Book of Acts. Why don't we limit it pretty much to the Gospels through the Book of Acts, because when we start with Romans and through most of the rest of the New Testament, not entirely, you're outside of Jerusalem and Judea, aren't you? You're in Colossae, you're in Corinth, you're in Rome, and so they're not really talking about the temple, or if they are, they may be talking about a pagan temple. Or they may be talking about the church as being God's temple today. But they're not really talking about the Jewish temple, Herod's temple in Jerusalem. And so we're going to find those references in the first five books. I can't say that I've got every one of them here. I did a printout. Nice thing about having Bible software is you can do this kind of search and then you can print it out. And so I've actually put that into my notebook notes as my printout of the places in Matthew through Acts where the word temple is used. And can go back and look at them, highlight what is in there. And the very first reference I find, just starting with Matthew, is going to be in Matthew chapter 4, I believe. Verse 5. And here it sort of shows up in a kind of an unusual place, doesn't it? Temptation of Jesus. Jesus is tempted. Three distinct temptations are mentioned of the devil tempting Jesus. The first one takes place apparently there in the wilderness or in the desert where he had gone to fast and pray in preparation for beginning his ministry. The second one takes place at the temple. The third one takes place on what is called a very high mountain. But when we get to the second one, it says in Matthew 4, verse 5, then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. That's the NIV rendering of that. I think many other translations actually say had him stand at the pinnacle. And of course, in our language, a pinnacle means high point. The pinnacle of the temple. So, there was at least a high point of the temple. Doesn't tell us where it was on the temple, does it? Doesn't even describe anything about it. But it calls it the pinnacle of the temple. Matthew could say that and not give any commentary about it because his first readers would have known what that meant. His 21st century readers may not. And we certainly don't unless we find some additional help other than just what's in this one verse. But so the temple has a pinnacle. When we keep moving through Matthew here, I'll just stop off at a few spots here to illustrate this. In Matthew 21, verse 12, Matthew 21:12, Jesus entered the temple area. So here's a reference, not specifically to the temple, but to the temple area, and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. And so he talks about the temple area here. And I'm looking right quick in my this, according to the interlinear, the word area isn't actually there. Jesus entered the temple. Did anyone catch, as we were doing this, it wasn't on your piece of paper to do. I just wanted to ask you today about it. As you were doing this, if you were actually using the printed exhaustive concordance, did anyone happen to notice what the Greek word was? You happen to notice what the Greek word was? The Greek word is the word hieros. Anglicized would be H-I-E-R-O-S. And that word, in its root form in the Greek, just meant that which is sacred or holy. And that word is used some 73 times, I think, in the New Testament, most of those having to do with the temple. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's another form of the word, talking about being that which is sacred or holy. All right. Now, here's the other thing. Some passages, you will, if you check the Greek word, you will find that it's not heros or heron, it's naos. What's the difference? Oops. Anybody have their Vine's Expository Dictionary? If you were to go check it out in Vine's Expository Dictionary or Mounts or Richards or whichever one you use, or even Strong's, or Thayer's, you'll find that heros seem to be used to just mean the temple in general. Whether it mean the outer courts or the main building that was called the temple, all of those would be incorporated in this word heron or heros, either way. But naos was reserved exclusively for the main complex, it's the main building itself. It was the sanctuary. That would be a word we would probably use.
It says the shrine.
There you go. Shrine, sanctuary. Think about realizing this isn't comparable, but just think about how our English language works. When we talk about, I'm going to go up to sunset. Well, as soon as you step onto the property, you're at sunset, right? And you step into the hallway outside the library, you're at sunset. When you're in the east foyer, you're at sunset. When you go into the auditorium, you're at sunset. But wait a minute, what if somebody says, I'm going to go up to the sanctuary? Realizing that in our language, it's permissible, though we seldom do it, to refer to the auditorium where the main worship goes as a sanctuary. Then, when you say that, when you step onto the parking lot, you're not at the sanctuary. When you're in the hallway, you're not. When you're in the east foyer, you're not. Only when you actually step into that area are you then in the sanctuary. See the difference between sunset as a building and then that part of sunset that might be called the sanctuary? They did that same thing with the temple. The whole area was Heros, temple. At least it's translated temple into English. But when they talked about the building itself, where the holy place was and the most holy place was, they might call that Heros, but most of the time they call that... How did it actually anglicize there? N-E-O-S? I forget. That's not it. It's N-I-O-S. Have to find... In AOS, Naos. Okay. And that meant the sanctuary, the sacred part. Certainly all of it was holy in a sense. Even the word Heros meant holy. But Naos really meant holy. That was the central part of it. And so you find both of those words being used depending on which part of the temple they're talking about, even as we're reading here in the English. And I'm not trying to distinguish so much between those as we look at these passages now, but you need to realize that would be a part of your research to discover that and see that.
Yeah, the Heron is, or Heros, would be the way that in Esau describes it is it's more of a general holy place. But it's basically one's like a holy. A sacred place would be Heron, and then Neos denotes the central sanctuary.
Okay, thank you. That's right. And the central sanctuary, Neos, the whole area, or references to parts of it would be the Heros. And so it says here, Jesus entered the Heros, the temple area. Now later, for example, whenever, you remember when Judas takes the 30 pieces of silver, and then in deep regret, he what does he do with those 30 pieces of silver? Do you know where he throws it? Into the Naos. He stands in front of the entrance to the holy place and throws it in there. That's what it says. Find the passage. We'll get to it directly. But the word naos is used there. He didn't just step onto the temple boundaries, you know, and just pitch it out there in the huge courtyard. He actually... And he was allowed. He was Jewish. He was a man. He could go all the way into the temple of... into the court of the men, the court of Israel, as it's called, which was close enough to the front door that he could literally have thrown the coins. And they get there.
Another word too we're mentioning is...
Now, it might have just landed on the front steps, but that would have been part of the naos.
Mm-hmm. Another word too we're mentioning is thusias teirion. Word for altar. Because at first when you're describing the difference between the two, I imagined like the building as being the Heros. And then Naos as being like this little spot. But then when you have the altar, for instance, in Matthew 23:35, it says one of the things that strikes me as kind of odd. It says that it implies that there's a place in between the temple and the altar.
Right.
Because the guy died in between the temple and the altar.
Yeah, and the word temple there is
The
Naos.
Naos, right.
Yes.
Which means even the inner side of the temple, there's a place in between that and the altar, which is strange
right.
to me. because I would expect the altar to be in there.
Right. Yes.
I was looking at the Strong's on the East Word, and it says that naos is coming from the word nail, which is to dwell.
Uh-huh. So the dwelling place.
Yeah. I find that interesting. That
right. Because that's the place where they literally thought of as God, in a sense, dwelt. It is interesting. If you go back, I can say something about 1 Chronicles 28 because that just happens to be where we are in our Sunday morning Bible class right now where I'm at. And where David is charging his son Solomon to build the temple and all of this. And he says there in 1 Chronicles 28 that his view of the temple when he's going to build it was not God's dwelling place, but David says, I am going to build a place for God's footstool. For God to put his feet. You know, David was a king, and he sat on his throne. Even kings like to be comfortable, and so they'd pull a footstool up there, and he could put his feet up. I don't know that he got as comfortable as some of us do in front of a television, but, a footstool. And he described the temple that Solomon's going to build as God's footstool. Where God's, in a sense, where God's feet were going to touch the earth. And of course, God then blessed that. And when Solomon actually built it and then they dedicated it, God blessed that by sending his presence in the form of a huge cloud of smoke and a flame of fire to come and go in to the place and disappear into the Holy of Holies eventually.
It's interesting you say that, because I wonder how that would tie in with this study on whether God is determining to live in this thing or whether men are trying to just give a spot for that.
Tell you what, we're just touching on so many things here. When you think about when God wanted to show his presence to people, sometimes it would be with fire, sometimes it would be with a cloud of smoke. You know, when it came out of Egypt, the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of smoke by day. When they came to Sinai, the whole mountain looked like it was on fire, it says, and it was covered by a great cloud of smoke. And then when they dedicated the tabernacle, smoke came down and covered the whole thing, and it represented God's presence. And then when Solomon builds a temple, a huge cloud of smoke comes down and settles over the whole complex. And then eventually disappears inside. When you get all the way down to the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel's writing at the same time as Jeremiah is. And while Jeremiah is busy trying to tell the king and the people that all this is going to be destroyed because of your wickedness, Ezekiel has this vision of the temple, and he sees suddenly the smoke and the flame of God's presence come out. Just the opposite of what it did in Solomon's day, come out of the Holy of Holies, into the holy place, out into the outer court, cross the Kidron Valley, and come up and came to rest on top of the Mount of Olives, and then disappeared over the other side and was gone. What was he telling his people? God had withdrawn his presence from the temple. And if God's presence wasn't there, it was just an ordinary structure, just like anything else. It was no longer a holy place. It was no longer the naos. It was no longer his dwelling. Okay? New Testament. Acts chapter 2. They're all together in one place, and suddenly, what happens? Flames of fire come down as if it settles on top of each one of them. Ever wonder what the significance would be of that to a Jewish person? God's presence. God's presence.
Even a little more potent than smoke.
Yeah. Okay. Chase that rabbit for a while. Let's come back. Matthew 21, Jesus goes into the temple area, and that's where he finds them doing all these things. They're selling doves. Money changers are there. Jesus says to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you're making it a den of robbers. And the blind and the lame came to the temple and he healed them. That's kind of interesting because the blind and the lame would not have been allowed into the court of Israel, that inner area right around the naos, they would not have been allowed in because of their disabilities. But they were allowed into the courts that surrounded it. And that's the area, and that's therefore the word temple there. That's where Jesus healed the man. In Matthew 23, Jesus in verse 16 talks to them about some of them were swearing by the temple. You know, they were making these oaths and they were trying to make them more believable to whoever they're making the oath to, that they would swear by the temple that this was true, or that they would do this. And they had considered that acceptable. But if they swore by the gold on the temple, and that tells us a little something. Later when we read about how Herod built the temple, we'll discover he put a great deal of gold on the outside of it, as well as on the inside of it. And part of the motivation for the Roman soldiers when they destroyed the temple caught on fire, or was set on fire, in the last days of the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem. And the fire burned so hot that the gold leaf that layered much of the outside of the temple proper melted and ran down into the cracks between the stones. And so once the temple fell and the Jewish resistance was finally crushed, these Roman soldiers, who on average were paid 1 denarius a day for their service in the Roman army, they literally take what we'd say crowbars or pry bars and started prying apart the stones of the temple to try to dig out the melted gold that had run down into the cracks. What did Jesus say would happen to the temple? Not one stone left on top of another. It all was because of that gold. Because of that gold. And here in Matthew 23, it mentions the gold. It says that they were not allowed to swear by the gold of the temple, but they could swear by the temple. They could swear by the altar that was up at the temple, but they couldn't swear by the offering that was on the altar. And Jesus condemned the whole thing, didn't he? All this nitpicking without any real respect for what was holy. If the gold was holy, then the temple was holy too. If the offering on the altar was holy, so was the altar. And so none of them should be used in their oaths. It was just a real lack of respect fundamentally on their part. Their legalism had turned them into people who really didn't have the real respect for God that their legalism at first made it look like they did. Well, we need to stop there and take our break.